Started. This afternoon's agenda, first up, we have an update from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Bradley. Nice to see you again.
In the hot seat. Thank you. Glad to be here. Happy to be here. It was a nice day for a drive down, so. Oh, worked just like you said it would. Again, Bradley Peterson with the firm of Flaherty & Hood. Here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, and I think I was with you about this time last year, giving a little bit of an update and maybe some prognostication or discussion of what may happen in the next session. I'm not going to go back and review what I told you to see if I was right or wrong, but I think an interesting session. As we're going along, so this is usually, just for your understanding, this is a little bit later than we usually meet with cities. And so I sort of have modified the presentation that we usually do to give you some of the highlights of what we worked on and some of the perspective in terms of the last legislative session, but also really wanted to kind of give you some insight, thoughts on the next year or so. Not only the next legislative session, but then the challenge for Greater Minnesota going into the elections of 2018. But if there's a topic that you want to dive into, dwell on a little bit more, please don't hesitate to interrupt or ask. Hopefully we can have just kind of a fairly informal discussion. What I've distributed is kind of our 2017 legislative report. It's kind of the full blow by blow. So there's quite a bit of detail in some of the handouts in terms of what we proposed, what we took to the legislature, and then what the outcome was. But just maybe to get started here, to remind you, the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities is now over 90 cities throughout rural Minnesota, everything ranging from a city the size of Renville, which is about 1,000 people, all the way up to you guys, and just about everything in between. We focus primarily on five issue areas, strictly from a Greater Minnesota perspective. So it's local government aid and property taxes, economic development, transportation, environmental, regulatory and funding issues, and then annexation and land use. And so those are really kind of the bailiwick, the universe that we operate in terms of the organization. The league covers the full waterfront of issues on behalf of all cities in Greater Minnesota, or in Minnesota. We really focus on Greater Minnesota issues specifically. So going into the 2017 session, we had a number of goals, and I'm really going to, I'll talk sort of broadly about these, and again, as I'm going along, if you want to dive in deeper into certain things, we can. First and foremost, return the local government aid program to its 2002 funding level. Going into the 2017 session, we were still $45.5 million short of where we were at in 2002. That's not inflation adjusted, that's actual dollars. Pass some good bonding provisions for infrastructure in Greater Minnesota, and we really focused on two things related to the bonding bill. First off, Governor Dayton, the last couple of years, has proposed quite a bit of money for clean water infrastructure, $167 million in a couple of different programs that the Public Facilities Authority administers. We've been supportive of those requests. There is a backlog as long as your arm of projects throughout the state that need attention, both from the perspective of upgrading old infrastructure and from the perspective of responding to new regulations from the MPCA. So in that perspective, we've been very supportive of bonding for those programs. The Greater Minnesota Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program is a grant program that is focused on helping communities in Greater Minnesota build out business development. It helps pay for the public infrastructure, and every now and again needs to be refilled through the bonding bill. So we've had some perspective, some proposals around that. Pass significant environmental regulatory reform. I'll talk actually in some depth about that here going forward. And then transportation, ensure that whatever final transportation package the legislature passed, that it would address two different issues. One, the Corridors of Commerce program, which has been very important for funding projects like Highway 14, Highway 23, things like that, where you've got interregional corridors that need to be expanded to accommodate the amount of business and traffic that they take, and also to make sure that it's done safely. And then city streets, not only for those cities under 5,000 that currently don't get any funding from the legislature or from the state, but also cities over 5,000 that also have challenges. If there's one thing that I hear traveling around the state from cities of all sizes, is that they need more tools to deal with city streets. And so we had some legislation around that. And then finally, some economic development items, workforce housing, job training, job creation fund, and the Minnesota Investment Fund are all issues that we worked on as well. So going into the session, of course, we had a change in the legislature with the Senate flipping to Republican control. So you had Republicans in control of the legislature, and of course, Governor Dayton, the Democrat, still finishing out his second term. So on the agenda, a lot on the agenda for this last year, not only the state budget for the next 2 years, but then also unfinished business in terms of the tax bill, which they failed to pass in both 2015 and 2016. That's typically where local government aid is taken care of. Bonding bill, which, you know, as you know, usually even-numbered years are years where they pass big capital investment bills. 2016, literally in the last 4 minutes of the legislative session, they tripped over themselves and were unable to pass a bonding bill. So they had that to deal with this year. And then transportation, which, of course, they've been talking about for several years, but making little progress on. And those three, well, four of those, despite the fact that it took a short special session to do, they were able to accomplish. And so looking at local government aid specifically, this is the one thing that most of our cities have in common to some extent or another. 2016 tax bill did include a $20 million increase in local government aid. As I said, our goal has been a $45.5 million increase. We were able to get legislation introduced to accomplish that on a bipartisan basis. A good mix of Republicans, Democrats, rural, urban, lots of folks. We had two Republican chief authors, since they're the folks who are in charge of the legislature, Representative Paul Anderson, who represents a district basically on the 94 corridor between St. Cloud and Alexandria, and then Senator Bill Weber, who is from Laverne. He's actually a former mayor, is so well acquainted with LGA. The governor, for his part, proposed a $20 million increase in his budget. And after kind of a lot of back and forth and backstory that I don't necessarily need to get into, the legislature's sort of first offer to the governor was $6 million of a one-time increase for 2018 only. And so what that would have meant was in 2018 there would have been a $6 million increase in the program, and then in 2019 we would have gone back to the 2017 level of funding, which of course doesn't make much sense if you look at LGA in terms of its property tax restraint mission. You know, cities would have found a way to spend that money, but they wouldn't have programmed it into their budgets necessarily. Probably would have spent it on a lot of one-time items, fire trucks, capital investments, that sort of thing. That first tax bill from the legislature was vetoed. So what ended up happening at the end of the day was a $15 million permanent increase to the base funding. So we are now at $534 million for 2018 and thereafter. Since 2013, when the legislature reformed the LGA program and put in a big infusion of money, we've actually increased the appropriation over about $108 million. And looking at what that would have meant for Rochester in terms of the old formula versus the new formula, Rochester, under the old formula, even if you put more money into it, was going to be losing money. And so going into 2018, if you look actually at this chart, the purple bars on the bottom graph there is what the final tax bill had. So going into 2018, you're looking at just about $7.5 million. Had the old tax formula been in place in 2018, your LGA would be about $3.6 million. I was pretty surprised when I had our analysts look at those numbers. And so I think the reform of the program and then the new money has worked out for Rochester. And according to our analysis, you've got several more $1 million to go before you kind of will hit the top in terms of what the formula says you should get. And so our mission will be to continue to add money into that program. And that's a relatively small part of your budget, but I think you're at least heading in a positive direction on LGA.
comment on that. Back in 2001, there was supposed to be a large increase in LGA. Actually, we would have been up to over $11 million back in 2003, somewhere in that time period. So the program has been in tough shape since then, and we have fought back. And we do benefit more under this new formula tremendously in comparison to the other formula that wasn't there prior to that time. So, and I think we get a greater share of the new money going forward as a result of that formula.
Yeah, some of the formula, the aspects of the new formula actually benefit a community like Rochester pretty significantly in that, for instance, one of the things that it looks like is jobs per capita. And obviously being a regional center, having all of the institutions in the town that you do have, you've got a lot of folks coming in to town to work. And so it really ups that jobs per capita number, and that goes into your need factor there. So it's been on balance, I think, positive from that perspective. Any questions about Local Aid before I move on? That's just the funding history for Rochester over the years. You see the flat years, 2010 to about 2013. That's when cities were potentially going to lose money, but we were able from year to year to kind of hold cities harmless. Gary references the 2002 number, and I think probably the number you were talking about was 2003. You would have been up amongst 11. But that's when there was a new governor and a $4 billion deficit, some changes were made at that point to the program. And then this is the graph that's in your packet that just shows each one of what would have happened to Rochester's local aid under various scenarios. So the blue is just current law. If there was, you know, no change, nothing happened, there would be a slight increase actually for all of you by virtue of how the formula works, which means because there was no new money that other cities would be getting a little bit less. And then you can see the CGMC proposal in green. We had kind of a stair-step approach to adding the $45.5 million. So by under our proposal, by 2019, you would have been over 8. And as it is, you're now looking at about 7.5 for 2019. And thereafter, there will be very small increases, again, due to just how the formula works from that perspective.
So you're still going to go after the increases in the future?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I think that if there's one thing that I can tell you with any level of certainty, is that for the near future, anyways, we'll be going after continued LGA increases. So, you know, our goal, at least for the last several years, has been to get back to the 2002 level. We're not quite there yet, so I could imagine that we'd put in another bill for about $30 million this year of an increase. One of the discussions, I think, amongst the group this fall will need to be, do we want to start talking more about an inflationary increase in the formula appropriation? Back in the late 90s, they're actually, the appropriation level did grow with inflation. And that was one of the proposals in 2013 with the new formula that we tried to press through, and we were able to convince the House, but not the Senate. So it's just a static number that's written into statute currently. The other thing that we spent quite a bit of time on is issues around water quality. You know, this has been an issue that CGMC has worked on quite a bit over the years in terms of the regulatory environment, really asking the question of, you know, for the amount of money that gets put into upgrading plants and facilities, is it having a beneficial effect on water quality? And this is something that, you know, obviously we take very seriously, our cities take very seriously the idea of having clean water, but we also want to make sure that when you're talking about multi-million dollar investments, that you are getting appreciable increase and difference in water quality. And if we're not, then I think we need to ask some hard questions about what is then the answer to improve Minnesota's water quality. And so we've been concerned. The recent MPCA standards have placed expensive mandates on cities without significant benefit to water quality. MPCA attempting to impose permit limits that are not supported by duly adopted rules. So the MPCA goes through a rulemaking process, a public process, where they set water quality standards. And what we're seeing in some communities is the fairly significant deviation once they go to implement standards in a permit from what the rule says. And so we've been, a number of communities have hired our firm on an individual basis to challenge their permits directly, but then we've also been taking collective action and putting a lot of pressure on MPCA to basically kind of hold them accountable to, hey, this is what you told the public the standard was going to be. If it's going to be something different, then you have to go through a transparent public process to get there, rather than just relying on a guidance document that you kind of cooked up in your office and put on the shelf and then pull off when you need to go implement a stricter permit standard. Another thing that we've been working on is...
What's the status of that effort?
So there is... it's interesting. So we, you know, introduced a bunch of legislation. There was a lot of discussion at the legislature around that issue, and then issues related to just peer review of MPCA science. I was involved in at least 13 meetings with some combination of the governor's office and the MPCA commissioner himself, and they would just not, we just couldn't get them there. The legislature was there. We couldn't get the administration there. It was very concerning on the unadopted rule piece specifically. The MPCA commissioner's argument was, well, sometimes we need some flexibility to respond to new trends or new technologies or emerging issues. And I said, okay, well, I can understand that, but how much of a deviation can there be from the original rule before it's inappropriate? And his answer, unfortunately, was, well, it depends. We have, like I said, there are a number of communities, especially the Minnesota River Valley right now, that have or are contemplating contested cases relating to their permits. We, on the underlying standard, the river eutrophication standard, have a lawsuit that we filed against the federal EPA, basically challenging their approval of the MPCA's rule, because we think that the MPCA is using some standards and test methods which were not appropriate for how they're using them. And so it's kind of in process. We were unable to make progress legislatively. The one thing that the MPCA did acknowledge after the legislative session, it's been very interesting. We put a lot of pressure on them during the legislative session, and then afterwards they're saying, well, you might have a point here, and this is how we'll modify our own behavior voluntarily, which of course we're going to have to then monitor and hold them accountable for. But they have basically acknowledged that from going forward, they will include whatever guidance documents or supporting documents by rule, by reference into the rules, ostensibly so that if they deviate from that, they would have to go through the rulemaking process again.
This is a major impact on the city's costs operating its water reclamation plants. These efforts will have a direct impact on us.
Well, I would say that, to me, the best thing that happened is they helped push through a bill that said that MMV had to do a study of what are the costs and benefits of some of the more restrictive standards. And they completed that study, and there were a whole bunch of cities they had to analyze around the state. Actually, Rochester was one of them. And say what the cost would be to our wastewater treatment plant if the standard went in. And the numbers were very high and really shocked the legislators and said we need to look and make sure there is a cost benefit these things moving forward. Actually, the numbers came out, I think for Rochester was like $129 million improvements to our wastewater treatment plant and about $14 million in annual costs. And actually the number that we had when we had our folks analyze it was $200 million and $20 million in operating costs. And since that, I do think that and some of the other efforts that the CGMC has made, I do think the PCA is more amenable to looking at this point at some standards that, you know, if you go from a 1.0 phosphorus standard to a 0.1 standard, it's a 1,000 times reduction. If you go to a 0.4, you may be able to accomplish something that is much more cost effective by just not going all the way down to this artificial standard. So that's where the issue now stands, and we're, you know, eventually we'll be getting a new permit for our wastewater treatment plant, and in there, depending on the standards and all that, may determine how much it may cost you to upgrade the wastewater treatment plant. But I think their work has had a significant impact, which I think is really the first time in a long time I've seen that significant an impact.
Yeah, I think it sort of goes in about 15-year cycles, where about 15 years ago we sort of fought some of these same battles, and there was, I think, an impact in terms of MPCA working more closely with cities, and then sort of over time they maybe drifted into some different habits, and now I think we're getting back to that. So during the session, you know, quickly, as I said, One of the things that we worked on was getting the, or if a city or a group of cities wanted to challenge a standard or an individual permit, to be able to compel the MPCA to do some independent scientific peer review. Right now, they claim to do some scientific review. What we can gather is very little of it is necessarily independent. It's all experts chosen by the MPCA with the questions that the MPCA wants answered. Sometimes they don't answer the questions that we think are at the heart of an issue, and so we have legislation around that. This is one of those items that since the end of the legislative session, the commissioner of the MPCA, John Langstein, actually issued a directive saying for all standard developments here on out, we will go through a scientific peer review process. One of the things that then we'll be having to do is to monitor that process they go through and make sure that it's definitely independent. We have some doubts about that already, actually, based on some things that are going on up north. But they have been responsive to these things on a voluntary basis after the legislative session, so we will see. The unadopted rules piece we talked about, one of the items that we had some legislation around, these first three all were stymied at the end of the legislative session by the administration, but the third one was to strengthen the standard of judicial review to ensure that MPCA was doing things that were appropriate. One of the things that we found sometimes when cities will challenge these things and take it to an administrative law judge or a district court is the analysis that the judge does is basically say, okay, did MPCA go through this step? Oh, they did? Yes, check. It doesn't necessarily evaluate whether or not the MPCA was responsive to questions, scientific questions, serious questions from cities. It doesn't necessarily take into account the evidence that MPCA used to arrive at their decision. Basically, it's did they check the box? Yes, okay. MPCA is okay. And so we had some legislation that would have strengthened that standard of review. Those first three we were unsuccessful on, but again, MPCA, after the session, after the fact here, are modifying some of their behavior. One of the other things is this is especially true for smaller communities that don't necessarily have a lot of staff, or perhaps their council only meets once a month, giving cities more time to review draft permits so that they can get their arms around what some of these things would really mean for their community in terms of cost. And then requiring MPCA to take advantage or take into account the most recent municipal investments when evaluating water bodies for impairment. This basically is making sure that when cities have upgraded their plants in the last 3 or 4 years, oftentimes when MPCA is looking at a water body impairment, they're looking at maybe data from 5 or 10 years ago. This is basically ensuring that cities are getting credit for recent activity, and that was written into statute as well. These things will be an ongoing discussion, and as we discussed, CGMC is involved in legal and regulatory action to try to hold MPCAs accountable. The Legislative Water Commission, which is a bipartisan group of legislators from both the House and the Senate, have taken an interest in some of these issues, and so CGMC is participating in those hearings over the interim. They're doing a series of three. They've had one already. There's two here before the end of the year. Again, monitor MPCA voluntary attempts at better process and transparency. One of the things that we're looking at, and again, this is especially in reference to some of the activity that's going on in the Minnesota River Basin, but I think would end up being something that would be an object of discussion statewide, is looking at what collaborative processes can we come up with to engage with point and non-point sources. Point sources of pollution being, of course, city wastewater treatment facilities, industrial facilities. Non-point sources being your agricultural runoff, that type of thing. We need to do more to encourage, I think, a discussion globally in our regions about how do we tackle some of these issues and what role cities can play partnering with agriculture to do those. There are some trading, sort of pollution trading programs based on cap and trade type of concepts that were done between communities in the Minnesota River Basin. But now we're looking at, okay, how can we up that and involve agriculture as well so that cities perhaps are paying for some improvements in best practices in terms of agriculture, but not as much as they would be paying if they had to do multi-million dollar upgrades to a wastewater treatment plant. So we're starting to initiate some discussions with folks in the environmental community, at the administration, and with the ag community around that. And that's hopefully something that we can get some traction on here in the next year or so. And then finally, continue to press for more state funding in the bonding bill. I mean, in some cases, it will just take more money to upgrade some of these facilities, especially when you're dealing with issues of age of infrastructure versus responding to the regulatory environment. Bonding bill, I think again I mentioned the water infrastructure and the Greater Minnesota Business Development Infrastructure Program. Senator Senjum, I think, deserves a lot of credit in kind of hitting the ground running in terms of moving a bonding bill this year at once they got into the legislative session. He had a bill introduced and moving along, modeled largely off of the failed bill from 2016, minus some of the more controversial issues, and moved it quickly through the session and kind of parked it where they need to pending activity from the House, which took a little bit longer. They didn't get their bill out until May. The final bill that passed during the special session had almost $1 billion in total cost, which is about what we thought it would be, about $117 million for the wastewater infrastructure programs and $12 million for the Greater Minnesota Business Development Infrastructure piece, and then, of course, numerous local projects throughout the state. And one of the things that we do in addition to advocating for specific programs is we really do try to hold the legislature accountable for making sure that the bonding bill is relatively balanced, metro versus rural, and that rural communities generally are getting their due. Finally, transportation. As I mentioned, the two things that we were involved in are the Corridors of Commerce program and city streets. We introduced legislation that would have provided some funding, although not enough, for cities of both under 5,000 and cities over 5,000. At the legislature, especially when you're dealing with some of these rural legislators with very deep rural districts who have 30 communities in their city, but all of them are in their district, but all of them are under 5,000. Those types of communities tend to get more sympathy in the discussion. We also introduced a bill for Corridors of Commerce looking for $200 million in ongoing funding so that we can finally complete projects like Highway 14 and the like. What they did in the end, and we have mixed feelings about this, to be honest, is they took quite a bit of general fund spending. Of course, one of the debates was, do you raise the gas tax, do you raise new fees, or do you just take money from the surplus and the state's existing revenues? The legislature won out in that discussion over the governor, and they're looking at about $173 million in new spending in 2018-2019, and then in the next biennium, over $400 million, and then they're doing $650 million in one-time bonding. We have some concerns about the level of general fund spending on transportation. We think that if it gets too big, because this is money they're taking from other things that they're already spending money on, that if it gets too big, that it tends to then threaten other priorities, such as local government aid. So that's something that we're watching. They did $300 million in one-time money for Corridors of Commerce, and that tends to get, and that's over 4 years, and that tends to get split evenly between the metro area and Greater Minnesota. There was some language in the transportation bill to try to add some more transparency to MnDOT's process on awarding Corridors of Commerce projects, and they're still trying to figure out what their scoring system will look like. We thought it'd be out right about now. Word from MnDOT is it'll still be a couple of weeks at least, and then they'll award projects next spring. And then for small cities, they did $8 million a year for 2 years, some city street funding. I think the way to think about this transportation package is really is a four-year deal. Because after that, we're not sure what's going to happen. There's been some discussion about a constitutional amendment that would dedicate some transportation-related taxes, such as sales tax on auto parts, passing a constitutional amendment that would dedicate that to transportation. Again, that's something that we as an organization historically have been very wary of because of locking up what otherwise had been general fund money. So that will be a discussion going forward if the legislature decides to go down that path next year. So that's kind of the what happened. The looking ahead to where we're going, there has been some analysis, and we spent quite a bit of time at the summer conference in Fergus Falls talking about this, is the high cost of the tax and transportation bills, along with the funding, increases in funding to Health and Human Services and K-12 education, would suggest that we may be putting ourselves in position for a deficit here in the not-too-distant future. They left little room in terms of the bottom line on the state budget, so that if there is a downturn, even a modest one, We could be looking at a deficit situation. And at least earlier this fall, the current tax collections were trending below what was forecast for several months in a row. And so all kind of negative omens. Just to give you a sort of sense of the increases in certain program areas, looking at K-12 education, the cost of the tax bill, health and human services, and transportation, you know, really the lines to focus on, because they're the biggest parts of the budget, are the K-12 education, which is the orange, and the purple, which is health and human services, because of course together those are both, you know, two-thirds of the budget. And so you saw pretty significant increases in those, in addition to a $650 million tax bill that reduces states' revenue collections over time. And the tax bill number only grows over time in terms of how much money the state will not be collecting. And so, you know, I think we need to be watchful in terms of what's happening with the state budget. On the positive side, we have as large a budget reserve as the state has ever carried, just about $2 billion. Not enough. Usually you like to be about 5% of your revenue collections. I think they're just at about 3.5% or so. So we're getting there. Challenges for the next legislative session. It's a short session. Doesn't start until February 20th. One of the major questions, I think, is will they get back on track in terms of the schedule of the bonding bill? As I said, you know, we tripped over ourselves in 2016. 2018 should be, they did a big bill in 2017. 2018 being an even year should be a big year. All indications that we're getting now talking to various legislators is that they would like to do a sizable bonding bill, sizable being in the neighborhood of $800 to $900 million. But again, you know, the political dynamic will come into play. You have elections for every member of the House of Representatives. You've got the governor's race. You've got a lot of legislators who are still eyeing running for governor. And so all of those dynamics will come into play. There's certainly no shortage of projects and programs that the legislature could fund through a capital investment bill. So we will be pushing that they do another round of investment to get kind of back on the legislature's schedule of, you know, big bills in the even years, emergency type smaller bills in the odd years. And that's what they've done in the past. In 2004, they missed a year in terms of doing a big bonding bill, and they made it up in 2005 and 2006. Hopefully that's the history that they follow this year. Deficit, I don't think that there will necessarily be one that they'll have to deal with immediately here, but there could be. There will probably be a supplemental budget of some sort where they move a little money around or spend a little extra on a couple of things. And as I mentioned, it is an election year for the House and Governor. And one of the things that the CGMC does during that process is we put out material to educate all of the candidates running for both of those offices. And so we'll, once the fields are set in the summer for the legislative candidates, put together a packet on all of our issues. Here's LGA, here's how it works, here's what it means, here's why it's important, the environmental regulatory stuff, transportation funding, all the rest. We've already started to actually engage with gubernatorial candidates. Over the next couple of months, we'll be inviting every major gubernatorial candidate to meet with our board and let us know what their vision is for Greater Minnesota and provide them some information on our priorities and perspectives. And then we'll see what happens in terms of the election of 2018. The Senate is not up this year, and so they'll ostensibly, unless there are some retirements or changes in people's personal circumstances, will stay held by Republicans. But the House up for election. Upcoming events, CGMC Fall Conference coming up in Alexandria. This is where we sort of set out our agenda for the next year and really drill in on our policies. So there's some material in your packet. I don't think there's anyone from Rochester yet signed up, but we would be happy to have any and all of you come to Alexandria for a couple of days. One of the discussions that we're going to be having is significantly around child care and access to affordable child care throughout rural Minnesota. This is a significant problem. A legislative panel, and then some discussion of our legislative priorities as well. Legislative Action Day is scheduled for March 14th. This is where we bring folks to St. Paul, brief you on the issues, let you loose on your legislators, and then enjoy some steak and perhaps wine at Mancini's that evening. And then our summer conference is slated for Mankato at the end of July. So with that, that's everything that I've got. I really appreciate the opportunity. I'm happy to take any questions. Very much appreciate Rochester's leadership and strong support for the coalition over the years.
All right, thank you. Gary, did you want to add some comments?
In the last gubernatorial election, we had a debate at the Civic Center. Are you planning on organizing those again for the candidates?
Yeah, I think we haven't settled on details yet, but 4 years ago, we partnered with the Rochester Area Chamber and the Post Bulletin and hosted a pretty successful, I think, gubernatorial debate. They really were trying to limit the number of gubernatorial debates there were, and so that year there were only five or six. And CGMC was the only local government group that hosted one. And so we had a good partnership with folks down here. We had 400 or 500 people at the presentation hall, I think it was. And so that's something that we'll be looking at somewhere in the state this year.
Bradley, one question I have, and I know it might be a bit too early, but going into the 2018 session, I know Rochester has some relatively modest requests in bonding. Do you have any feel at all from what you're hearing and other requests on how our requests might stack up?
Well, you know, you're probably looking at a total bill of, let's just say, $900 million between state agencies and local units of government. You're probably going to have $3.5 billion worth of requests. You know, it's always a competitive process. You know, from the local government perspective, having worked on some of those, I know that they're not all created equal and some are much better than others. And so, you know, some of them tend to get kind of dropped off pretty quickly. I think it'll be a pretty competitive year, bonding-wise. My sense is the legislature will want to do quite a bit again on, you know, infrastructure, roads and bridges, that sort of thing. And so when you sort of look at then, you know, taking, you know, $300 or $400 million kind of to satisfy some of those infrastructure, higher education, asset preservation, that type of thing. You know, the pie for local units of government shrinks pretty quickly. But I would imagine that your request should be fairly well positioned.
Okay. Well, especially I think as we connect it with serving some of the greater purposes like transportation, things of that nature, such as with the Public Works Operations Center, promoting more public transit, things of that nature. So I think the better job we do in connecting with the higher goals of the legislature, the better our requests will be received.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the extent to which you're, you know, leveraging, you know, local dollars, federal dollars, other sources of revenue for those also helps.
Okay. Mr. Woodger.
I want to talk about my first, second, and third priority at the state level, and they're all street utilities.
Okay.
So what's the prospect of actually getting something to happen?
Yeah, you know, I think that that's one, you know, where I think there needs to be some new energy. There are, you know, the League of Cities a couple of years ago had been working on the street improvement district concept, and it didn't get a lot of traction. And then kind of the issue sort of went a little bit dormant. But I do know, you know, again, you know, I think there's been some discussions with the other first class cities. I know this is a huge issue for the city of Duluth. They're obviously looking at a local option sales tax, an additional local option sales tax to fund some of their street maintenance needs. And so I think there's an opportunity for a discussion. I think you probably need to look at it as maybe a couple of year project. My guess is that, you know, the legislature may say, well, we did transportation last year. It might set it aside for the year, especially it being a short session. But I've always been one of the belief that you need to start talking about things and planting seeds and kind of pushing ideas. And it might take a year or two to kind of grab hold. I think the city of Rochester is probably well positioned to sort of be a leader on this discussion. And so, you know, I think that's something that I think there's some interest in, and certainly from other regional centers as well. I think there's interest at the first class city level. You know, once Minneapolis and St. Paul get through their ugly elections and, you know, sort of set a course for themselves. And I know the city of Duluth has interest in this issue. So I think it's something that, you guys can be leaders on, and I think that there are a lot of other coalition cities that are interested as well. I mean, I know the city of Moorhead is, and Grand Rapids, and others around the state.
I talked to Bradley and Tim Flaherty about this last, before the presidential election, and our thought was at the time that it might be more reasonable to tackle it as a first-by-city approach rather than as a statewide approach, and we've had a few initial discussions along those lines, both with their firm and with some of the cities, but getting it to firm up is, you know, something we need to do some more work on, see if we push something. I agree with Bradley, some of these things you need to go in and realize you're going to fail for a couple of years, but it kind of builds momentum sometimes, you know, even by doing that. So I do think it is something that I think it's got to take a different approach than the statewide approach. It didn't seem like that got much attraction, and if you're talking to the league folks, I don't think it's something they're going to be able to take a big run at this year. So I think it really is more something we should plan our own strategy for.
Okay. Then, so we don't have anyone from Rochester. Are you going to be able to get up to the conference for the coalition this time, or?
I doubt it. Bradley and I talk frequently, so.
I'm interested in particular in the child care issue, because that's, housing is clearly the number one affordability issue that I see, but child care is right up there. And I'm just not entirely sure what cities are able to do in terms of child care, other than, you know, doing something with the school district through early childhood education.
Yeah, I you know, just kind of anecdotally, it's interesting. There's a lot of energy around child care, and a lot of folks have recognized it to be a huge barrier to economic development in their communities. Mm-hmm. And different cities are looking at different solutions, and so and are encountering the problem in different ways. So. You've got the Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation, which on their own has been funding training and getting home-based childcare up and running. They've, you know, trained over the last 4 to 6 years a couple of hundred people, individuals, I think. The city of St. Peter, I know, has done a lot of work in this issue, actually going back 20 years or so. They, of their own initiative, rehabbed a building and leased it to a nonprofit childcare provider, and then also have been trying to tackle the home-based issue. And their take on it was that they agreed to, they helped kind of set up a training program, and they waived any city fees related to setting up a home-based childcare business, and then paid any other county, state licensure fees, inspection fees, all of that sort of thing. On behalf of folks who are interested in doing that. I think they had 9 people start the program and 7 ended up going all the way through. So there are different things that cities are doing. And, you know, from the coalition's perspective, we're just starting to get on the front end of this discussion. You know, again, you know, city streets are the things you, one of the things you hear a lot about. Mm-hmm. And I've heard a lot about child care traveling the state the last 4 or 5 months, whether it was, you know, up on the range where they're trying to get a 24-hour child care facility because of all the shift work with the mines. Or, you know, a city like Jackson, Minnesota, which there's nobody providing child care service. And so we're actually going to have a pretty robust discussion the first day of the conference, that Thursday, on child care. And I think we're trying to figure out from, you know, the coalition's perspective is what role can we play in perhaps putting together some legislation. And again, you know, this might be kind of a 2-year discussion. Mm-hmm. You know, given the sort of limited nature of this legislative session, of putting together a package, putting together kind of the case for it, talking to folks during the election season about it, and then making it a full-fledged priority for 2019.
And I think part of the issue with the, usually we have some people that are interested in going to the coalition meetings, myself included, but you're being right on top of the National League of Cities this year is creating a...
Yeah, the problem is there's like a day and a half in November between deer hunting and Veterans Day, elections, Thanksgiving, you know, that you can kind of plan things. So it's, we run into that.
I will tell you, I already asked that question, Michael.
And then last thing for me is that affordable housing, huge issue down here, really hurting a lot of families. And one of the things that we hadn't seen before that we're seeing now is disruptions in the 4% tax credit. market. Mm-hmm. It used to be that was just kind of the given. 9% were competitive, but you could go and get the 4%. Mm-hmm. And now between the competition in that program and also the disruptions in the market, all of a sudden that's no longer become a source of housing funds.
Right.
Anything that at the state level we can be doing to address that?
Well, we've sort of, I mean, our take on it has been to try to develop programs and solutions outside of the federal programs that the state participates in. Because I think one of our concerns has been that you're building relatively costly units once you kind of factor in all the people who get paid in that process. Mm-hmm. Secondly, you know, we've been trying to, you know, because in a lot of communities that have a housing crunch, it has less to do with the household income of folks who are looking to buy a house as with just the market working to provide them with a house, right? And so a lot of those programs tend to be income limited, whereas especially in a one company town like Roseau, you know, you've got a different group of folks that your clientele that you're looking at. So the solutions that we've been looking at have been kind of outside of those things. We looked at a workforce housing tax credit modeled on something North Dakota was doing. Worked on it for 2-3 years. Couldn't get the legislature to bite. They seem to be more interested in putting funding into some of the existing programs that have some of these limitations. And then there's a grant program that was created through DEED that I think mirrors what we're trying to accomplish and maybe just needs to be expanded.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for the update. I'm sure we'll be talking as the legislative session gets underway. I know we took more time than we wanted today, but this is an important topic as we get geared up. So thank you again.
I appreciate the opportunity, and good luck with the rest of your meeting. Yeah.
All right. Thank you. All right, moving on to our second item today is an ethics ordinance review that was included in our package of suggested changes. Mr. Atkins?
Thank you. I first want to acknowledge the presence of the board chair, Kay Batchelder, along with board member Lawrence Collins and Faye Harris. Thank them for showing up as well. This item appears on the agenda at the request of several of you as recently. To take a look at the Code of Ethics and the way the Ethical Practices Board operates. On its own initiative, the Ethical Practices Board determined that one section of the Code of Ethics was in need of some work that was contained some language that did not provide the most definitive roadmap as to what conduct was being prohibited. And so with that background, the board has reviewed several draft changes, and if you take a look at page 3, you will find the version that the board has approved as recently as last week. On 13.02, the overstrike language represents language that would no longer be in the ordinance if you were to adopt the recommendation. There was no new language added. Now, at the bottom of page 3 over into page 4, there are also some changes. Those are all housekeeping changes. The board determined that the discussion on who should fill out a disclosure form, the ethics disclosure form, instead of being a standalone ordinance, should be part of the ordinance that talks about the disclosure form. And for that reason, the board is recommending the movement, if you please, of what you see at the bottom of page 3 over to page 4, where it belongs in the section dealing with the ethics disclosure form. And so that really is all that I have. This is the recent effort by the board to try to be more definitive in providing some guidance to public officials, and that's why it comes to you for your consideration at this time.
All right. Questions, comments?
So I ascertain in looking at this that full cooperation is entirely removed from the ethics ordinance altogether.
That last sentence would be removed.
Well, that's just peachy.
Mr. Campion.
So section 1305, there's clarification of who's required to disclose or to fill out a disclosure form. The end section says any person who seeks appointment to any city board, commission, agency, or committee. What would fall under the definition of agency?
Well, it's a catch-all. So if you come up with something other than a board, commission, or committee, it would probably fall with an agency. And this is existing ordinance.
Right. It's just being added here to clarify.
Before this section existed, there was a laundry list. The Music Board, the Energy Commission. And every time the council would add a new commission or board, we'd have to go into the ordinance to update it. And so instead of that catch-up game, the board recommended and you agreed to simply have this basic requirement. You know, anybody who's seeking appointment to any board, commission, committee, or agency of the city be required to fill out an ethics disclosure form.
Okay. Coming forward November 6th.
I'm sorry?
When would you be bringing this to council?
It depends on how it's how you respond to it today.
I respond favorably. That's just me. Mr. Hickey.
Yeah, just I was just curious what some of the thinking was like on 1302. So, like we struck out, shall be dedicated to fulfilling the responsibilities of office. So we don't want people to be dedicated to.
No, I wouldn't take the reverse. Okay. Instead, it says if you accept this change, public officials shall be dedicated to the public purpose in all programs developed by them. The problem with dedicated to fulfilling the responsibilities of office was its vagueness and ambiguity. What does that mean? Okay. Does that mean that that if you disagree with your one of your compatriots, that somehow you're not fulfilling the responsibility of your office? So the board decided that instead of that type of ambiguous language, that they would suggest that we just stick with dedicated to public purpose and programs.
All right, Mr. Campion.
Yeah, just circle back on my other question was. Has the board addressed the matter of requests for recusals that took place as part of the review process of a few of the matters that came forward? I saw some basically public entering requests that people recuse themselves of matters before the board using fairly ambiguous and not well-structured arguments. There doesn't seem to be a guide in here for what would require someone's recusal. I'm just wondering, has there been discussion as a board about that process going forward?
There's a pending request pending before the board from a law firm representing the Days Inn property in response to three members of the Heritage Preservation Commission and comments that they have made. There was an opinion issued back in 2009 by the Ethical Practices Board in response to a court case that dealt with a council member in Minneapolis who spoke most openly about her views about a pending matter, and the court found that to be a denial of due process. My question is that opinion still valid? The board last week decided to take another run at that opinion. There might be an effort to fine-tune it or to provide for changed circumstances or new information. And they're going to discuss that further on November 20th. That's the only discussion that's pending before them on recusals. As to recusals in general, no, there's no discussion pending at this time.
Okay. That was, I think, one of the parts I saw that concerned me most about the process was people being potentially levered into recusing themselves as kind of a public, really a matter that played out very publicly about look at maybe support for one candidate or support for one cause, thus impugning their ability to discharge their office. And certainly no part of the code seems to suggest that you must remove yourself and become completely unbiased in all decision making in order to sit on the Ethical Practices Board. We do seem to be looking for humans with that experience. And it just seemed to me to really start to flavor this as more of a potentially political step that would happen is everyone gets into gaming who's going to recuse themselves and who's not going to recuse themselves. I was hoping that maybe there was some conversation about a shared kind of mutual fabric about what's going to be grounds for a recusal instead of, and it doesn't have to be necessarily codified, but it was somewhat, it's disappointing, I guess, to hear that sort of kind of hopefully retrospective kind of maybe a little bit of navel-gazing isn't taking place to make sure that we're all operating on the same shared kind of values about what should cause a recusal and what shouldn't.
Two responses. First of all, the recusal only would apply to a quasi-judicial matter. not to a legislative matter.
Right. In which case it should be clear, right?
Right. Quasi-judicial more often than not involves land use, but for example, at 5 o'clock tonight, this afternoon, we'll have three quasi-judicial matters
right.
on the agenda. Secondly, some of the sentiments you just expressed, we heard last week from the board members themselves.
Perfect.
And so they're listening, and they want to talk further on the 20th of this month, and I'm sure this will be discussed further.
And if I'm saying anything out of class, I'd prefer, you're welcome to call me and let me know, and we can have that conversation. But the entire particular process obviously bothered me quite a bit. But thank you for your service. That is not at all meant to impugn your guys' service and dedication to our city. I appreciate you being here and all the work you've done on the board.
Okay, Mr. Woodard.
One of the things that was not clear previously, and I don't know if this agency thing addresses it, but my understanding is the Code of Ethics and Conflicts of Interest would also apply to the Ethical Practices Board appointing authority or agency. Does that need to be spelled out clearly, or is that not something that's in here?
Well, you throw me a curveball a bit, so I'd have to pull up the actual Code of Ethics to see its application section. So give me a moment, and I will do that.
The point being is that if you're a part of the appointing authority and you have a conflict of interest, it would seem to me it would seem reasonable to me that they would also be subject to the Code of Ethics, but it's not necessarily the case.
The provisions of this chapter are applicable to all public officials. The term public official. It's defined to mean any member of the council, any city agency, board, commission, committee, or other voting body, department head, employee, official, supervisor, volunteer, or other person who is elected, appointed, employed, hired by contract, or in any manner authorized to act on behalf of the city. So the answer to your question is it does apply.
So right now our appointing body does not does not provide a disclosure of any conflicts of interest, and they do not necessarily recuse themselves if they have conflicts of interest?
Well, you asked two different questions. The disclosure form is governed by a separate ordinance.
Okay.
And members of boards or commissions, it says members of boards or commissions created by ordinance, so there's a bit of more limiting factor in that definition. We would have to expand that to include the committees or agency language if we wanted to make
so
it clear.
How do we root out when conflicts of interest exist with appointing authority?
Well, as within any other case, it's self-reported. In other words, we rely on the individual to indicate whether they have a conflict of interest or not. And it seems to me that has happened once in the past.
Okay.
With the appointing committee.
But the bottom line is we don't need to change anything. Conflicts of interest exist with the appointing committee.
The chapter applies, except if you want a disclosure form from the appointing committee, then we do have to make a change.
Okay. No, that's, I guess I would prefer to have that on there because it...
Have what on there?
Have them disclose what their conflicts of interest are.
All right, so your disclosure form.
Well, and that's just my opinion. I mean,
all right, I understand, but if it flies, I need to know which way the wind is blowing.
So to expand the disclosure form language to include the broader agency language.
Right, and that would include the appointing committee, which is the president of RCTC, the chancellor of the University of Minnesota Rochester, and the president of the Olmsted County Bar.
I mean, if they have conflicts, they're already obligated to admit them. It's just the documentation of conflicts.
And failure to do so would be a violation of the code.
Yes.
That's good to know. Well, anyway, so that's, there's any consensus on that?
Mr. Ruska?
Mr. City Attorney, if there was, with those three designated positions, if they declined and just said, you know, I'm not interested if all this stuff has to be done, would we have a plan B? I mean, who would
no.
be?
So we don't. When I drafted this back in 2008, I wasn't sure I was going to get those three on board, quite frankly.
That's kind of what I'm wondering.
I did some begging and fortunately for us, I think we had three individuals who found the subject of ethics extremely important and interesting because they deal with it in their own businesses and jobs and responsibilities, and so they were very willing to serve. What keeps me up at night at least between now and February 16th, is the fact that one of them is going to, or two of them will recuse themselves because of a conflict, and I've got one person making the decision.
Yep.
So I don't have a plan B.
Well, I'm just wondering if we don't want to figure out some process where we do, and I'm not sure what that would be, but you know, that maybe it would come to council for approval of a designated person to fill in that.
Yeah, see, that's, you know, that that's the problem. As soon as I involve the council in doing something, I've broken the independence of the appointing committee.
Yeah, I see that. Okay.
That was the beauty, quite frankly, of the appointing committee, was nobody from the city was involved.
Right. I just, you know, I mean, devil's advocate is, you know, kind of look at this, but what if?
Hopefully,
you get to that position, then you're going to say, now what? And yet, if we don't think ahead of it ahead of time.
Well, let's bounce it around and I'll see what I can come up with.
I want to voice support for the changes that were outlined. Sorry, before we got away from that, because we sometimes do, but I appreciate it.
I want to finish here. One of the other things that I talked to Terry about a little bit after we'd gone through a process on this, and I hope that these things rarely, if ever, come back to us. It's nice that they don't. But I think that, and I'm not sure if this fits right into this area, but one of the things that I noticed was a process to require the council to address the findings of a violation, or, you know, when the group comes to a finding, we kind of had this discussion here a few months ago, there's nothing that says we have to act or even review this or do anything. And I think that, and after I've gone through it, I think just the idea that in support of what the Ethics Committee does and the work that they do, they have findings that it should come to the council for some type of action, or at least some type of acceptance of it. So it just seems to me that that was kind of one of those kind of stumbling blocks that we came upon during the process. And so I'll just throw that out there. I don't know if it's up to if the council feels the same way, but to have it be kind of dead-ended with who knows, we don't know what needs to be done or if anything needs to be done at this point is something that I think deserves a little discussion and attention.
I won't address the merits, but I'll tell you that the way I drafted this ordinance, and I did it with a reason, the Ethical Practices Board's job is done once they come to their finding. It's up to the appointing authority, or in this case yourselves, as to what you do, if anything, with those. You do have the authority under the Home Rule Charter to adopt rules of your proceedings. If you were to come up with such a rule or requirement, I would suggest you do it as part of your own rule of proceeding, not part of the ethics ordinance.
Okay. Right. And as I said, I'm not sure it's in here, but I believe that's what I was addressing when I said that after we've gone through the process once, I think there's room for improvement. That would be the area that I felt was a little lacking in what happens with these when they are done. We know we get our annual report from them, and again, I echo the thoughts. You guys do a great job, and I appreciate the work they do. For them to make a ruling and have it just drop off from there, I think is probably not the way it should be done. So just something I want to throw out.
Mr. Dickey.
So if we did it as part of the rules, it'd be that annual, where we do whether it's a debatable motion and that?
Yes.
Okay.
The first meeting in January is your annual meeting. You adopt Roberts, you adopt your order of succession, blah, blah, blah. You can adopt an order indicating that, and I'm going to think off the top of my head, every matter that comes before the council from the Ethical Practices Board shall be responded to, something like that.
Sure. Okay.
All right. We can only set our rules then?
Pardon?
We can only set
our rules.
No,
you can do it any time, actually, perfect. But the practice is I'm doing in January.
I just wanted to make sure.
All right. Mr. Wojcik.
So next issue that I wanted some guidance, I don't know if it has to be in the ordinance or not, but we need some consistency around whether campaign contributions, giving or receiving, represent a conflict of interest, because I've seen it handled both ways. And, you know, I do think we need to spell that out quite clearly. It can't be handled differently depending on who the person is. How would we go about giving guidance as to whether or not campaign contributions or support represent a conflict of interest?
Well, I'll put it on the next agenda for the board and let them thrash that out. They've got a couple items on there that might take some time, but it might take some time to get to it. But I'll see how the board responds to that.
Because even within the same item, you have different people doing different things, and that kind of inconsistency wrecks the process. And then third question. My understanding in the way that this was previously written is that the Ethical Practices Board can recommend changes to the ordinance. However, they cannot implement changes by themselves.
Correct. Only a council can adopt an ordinance.
Well, and that's, you know, that's a particular concern that I've seen, because we've seen them adjust the language on these items to insert words. And what is the, I don't see a process in here for appealing that. And the particular case that I'm mentioning is when there's a standard that's in place, and then they change it to the standard to being a tempting set standard. Now that's a it's a different definition, a different threshold. What is the recourse or the action to address that?
Change of ordinance.
But
because there is no appeal body,
right?
There is nothing in the ordinance that says somebody may appeal the finding of the Ethical Practices Board to somebody else.
But it is clear then that the Ethical Practices Board can't change these standards on their own.
They can't change the ordinance. There is obviously interpretation involved in and words, especially those that are ambiguous.
Okay.
Which, quite frankly, maybe some of the reasons behind some of the recommended changes here to take away the ambiguity.
And then lastly, there's an issue in here that I've always been cognizant of, and it's always kind of left me uneasy, is that there's essentially a mandatory reporting requirement for all officials in the Code of Ethics.
The disclosure form?
I believe the ordinance actually says that if you are aware of a violation of another official, you are obligated to report it.
Yes.
And that is that really what we want? I mean, that does obligate all of us if we're aware of a potential conflict. And, you know, from time to time, some of us are sometimes maybe put in a situation where we are then obligated to report. And if we don't report, we ourselves are guilty of violating the ordinance. So this is one of those be careful what you wish for, because right now it's pretty clear. And there's, you know, that means, you know, staff, council members, anyone that's doing something that's, you know, that the person feels violates the Code of Ethics now is obligated to report it. And that's the way it reads right now, and I could go either way with that, but I just wanted to either affirm or review whether or not that's the case.
I think my issue with that particular section is, to what level of certainty must I know, right? So as council people, we hear, what's the word I'm looking for?
Allegations
of impropriety on a hourly basis. And so at what level must I be certain of something before it becomes my responsibility to basically out someone as, you know, potentially violating the standard? Is it beyond a reasonable doubt? Is it, reasonable? What's the reasonableness threshold? I can understand why that causes some tribulation.
Well, all I can do is offer to put it on the board's agenda and see if they have a recommendation, and if they do, I'll share it with them.
I think sounds like they're going to be busy.
It does.
All right. Picking up on Mr. Campion's comment, I'm also satisfied with the suggested changes. I think it retains the more substantive portions. Shall not exceed their authority or breach the law. Those are pretty critical, and remove some of the more ambiguous language that could be subject to more interpretation. So I'm okay with these changes.
I will put it on the agenda for the 6th.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Anything else on that topic?
No.
One other item I was just going to mention, just I don't know where you go with it, back to Mr. Rusk's question. The Charter Commission is the only other body that has a distinct separation from the council.
That's state law, yes.
Yes, so if you were looking for a possible substitute, that might be a body to look toward. I don't know, I'm just throwing that out there. Given that those are the only two bodies that are distinct from the council control.
So perhaps the chair of the Charter Commission could appoint someone to replace an Ethical Practices Board member on if a vacancy should occur because of a recusal.
I'm just throwing that up only because
That's a possibility. We keep the independence, which is what the primary overreaching goal was when this board was created. Keep it separate.
Giving you an option for your plan B.
And what about, you know, plan C is also, we've got the three parties that are in there. What happens if, do we still lose the impartiality if we say, or their designee? Should they recuse themselves?
So you don't trust them to make an ethical appointment, but you
trust
them
to appoint the replacement.
Appoint a replacement, a proxy. It does become a rabbit hole. This bootstrapping of boards thing is a real. I don't know how
you can give it some thought.
All right.
Those are just some ideas. Okay. Any other business for the committee of the whole? And once again, we'll be adjourning to the council chambers to carry out the recessed council meeting.
And we can't actually officially start that till 5, right?
Correct.
That's what was noted.
So, any other business for the committee?
20 minutes.
All right, then.
Thank you, sir.
See you all in 2 minutes.
Hey, Nick, you got a couple minutes?
Yeah, I got to talk to Mr. Whitman over there.